Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, everyone. It is Tuesday, the 29th day of October in the year 2024. And I thank you very much for joining me today for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Anglewitz, and I'll be reading from today's edition of the paper, along with related articles that may have appeared in the past couple of days. We'll begin with a story that comes to us from Cameron Joseph, staff writer from Washington, D.C. His article is titled, "Election Week Could Be Just As Long and Fraught as in 2020. During Election Week 2020, Seth Bluestein never went to sleep. Mr. Bluestein, then Philadelphia's Chief Deputy Election Commissioner, woke up on Election Day to oversee the tallying of hundreds of thousands of votes. The next time he got some shut-eye was 3 days later on Friday. We knew that we had to continue counting 24/7 until every ballot had been canvassed, and that's what we did, he says. As he worked, he came into the crosshairs of the Trump campaign, which falsely claimed that their candidate had won the state and that something fishy was going on in Philly. After Donald Trump's surrogate criticized Mr. Bluestein by name during a press conference, anti-Semitic messages and death threats poured in. We had to get police protection outside of my house to protect my wife and kids while I was at the convention center counting ballots, says Mr. Bluestein, who is now the Republican commissioner on Philadelphia's election board. It took until Saturday before enough ballots were counted for news networks to call the state and the election for Joe Biden. Steps could have been taken to lower the risk of a repeat scenario for 2024. But the state's GOP-controlled legislature refused to heed bipartisan pleas to let officials process mail votes before Election Day, meaning it will still take days to tally all of those results. That could lead to another drawn-out election with no clear winner for days. And delays leave a void for bad faith actors to step in and attack the system. The window of time from when the polls close until the race is called is the largest window for and disinformation and harassment and threats, Mr. Bluestein says. First, the good news. Vote counting will likely go faster in most states this time around. The country is no longer conducting an election at the height of a global pandemic, so fewer people are opting to vote by mail, based on early 2024 mail ballot requests and returns. Mail votes simply take much longer to count because those ballots require many additional steps of verification and preparation. And some swing states have taken steps to improve election law to speed up the vote counting process. But the four crucial battleground states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Nevada all will likely take a while to fully tabulate their returns. If the race is as close as polls suggest, that will likely leave America waiting for days to know who their next president will be in a highly fraught election excuse me, that many voters from across the political spectrum feel is an existential turning point for the country. Sorry for that pause. I was interrupted here in my reading. Anyway, let's continue with this article. Election disinformation has already picked up in intensity. Last week, A video went viral purporting to show someone destroying Republican mail ballots in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, a critical swing county. State and local officials quickly showed that that video was fake, but not before it racked up hundreds of thousands of views on the social platform X. U.S. intelligence officials said Friday that they believe it was a Russian disinformation effort. Slow counting is frustrating, but it isn't an actual problem. The challenge comes when high-profile politicians such as Mr. Trump cast aspersions on the process that, while slow, is overwhelmingly accurate. In the aftermath of the 2020 election, the former president declared victory on election night, even as millions of votes remained to be counted. He tried to overturn his election loss for months and has continued to insist, with no evidence to back his claims, that he won, while refusing to promise he'll accept the results this time. On Friday, Mr. Trump posted on his social media about the supposed, quote, cheating and skullduggery, unquote, of the 2020 election, while warning about 2024. When I win, those people that cheated will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, which will include long-term prison sentences, so that this depravity of justice does not happen again, he posted. If Donald Trump perceives that he's losing, I think we're likely to hear him declare victory on election night and spread lies about the election, says David Becker, a former Justice Department Civil Rights Division attorney who heads the nonpartisan Center for Election Innovation and Research. 43 states allow county election officials to begin pre-processing mail ballots before Election Day, checking to make sure the ballots are valid, removing them from envelopes, smoothing them out so that they can go through tabulating machines, but not counting the votes themselves. That lets those states move vote counting along at a faster pace on Election Day. But Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are exceptions, which slows down vote counting in two states that have been pivotal in the past two presidential elections. On top of that, neither state has in-person early voting, meaning the only way to vote before Election Day is by absentee ballot. Wisconsin has in-person absentee voting, where people can vote absentee ballots at election sites. That means those states have many more absentee ballots to process than other states. Former Kentucky Secretary of State Trey Grayson, a Republican, says it was, quote, really unfortunate that Pennsylvania didn't change its law to allow pre-processing of ballots. When you start having a lot of people vote by mail, you really do need the pre-process. Otherwise, your results aren't going to come in as quickly, he says. In Pennsylvania, Republicans refused to pass legislation allowing pre-processing unless Democrats first expanded the state's voter identification requirements. In Wisconsin, a bill to allow pre-processing passed the GOP-controlled assembly with bipartisan support, but was stonewalled by hardline Republicans in the state Senate. The counties that tend to take the longest to count their ballots are invariably large urban areas, which tend to be racially diverse and heavily Democratic, places like Philadelphia and Milwaukee. That's largely because so many more votes come in that it takes longer to accurately tabulate them all. But it feeds into racially tinged conspiracy theories that local Democratic machines are rigging the vote. Milwaukee has new vote counting machines that can tabulate 100 ballots per minute, a big improvement over the old machines that could only process 7 ballots a minute in 2020. But the main bottleneck is physically verifying the votes and preparing them for the machines. If Milwaukee gets their results in by 2 a.m. Central Standard Time, I'd be delighted, says Ann Jacobs, a Democrat and the chair of the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission. We're going to have late results that will result in significant numbers coming in all at once. And that significant number all at once will be from largely Democratic-leaning communities, our larger urban areas, she continues. It's just the math. Michigan used to be in the same boat, but the state is likely to count its votes faster this time around. In 2022, voters passed a state ballot initiative that is allowing in-person early voting for the first time. While early counts of in-person early voting have been relatively low, voters who cast their ballots that way rather than through the mail make it easier on county clerks to tally the votes. On top of that, Democrats who control the state's legislature and governorship passed a law allowing pre-processing of ballots, meaning they'll be able to move that mail votes much faster. In Georgia, which has always counted its votes relatively quickly, lawmakers and elected officials have put a major emphasis on speeding up the count. Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger told the Monitor last month that the goal is, quote, free, fair, and fast, unquote. State courts also struck down a bevy of controversial last-minute election rule changes pushed through by hardline conservatives on the state election board, including one that would have slowed down the state's vote count by forcing poll workers to hand count the number of ballots cast in every county on election day. We're likely to see the same, quote, red mirage as last time in a number of states that process their mail ballots later than in-person ballots. Preliminary early voting numbers across various states show that registered Democrats are still voting by mail at a much higher rate than Republicans this election, though in smaller numbers than in 2020. In the states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, where those Democratic-leaning batches are counted last, that means early numbers will appear better for Mr. Trump than the final result. And in states like Nevada and Arizona, where mail voting is dominant, it will simply take much longer to tabulate the ballots, something that's been true long before the Trump era. Most Western states of all political persuasions have adopted predominantly mail voting elections over the past two decades, making their vote counting simply take longer. Hotly contested Arizona is a heavily vote-by-mail state that for decades has taken a long time to count its ballots, long enough that it has regularly taken days and even weeks to know who won close elections. Former President Trump has used that slow process to cast doubt on the results for years. In 2018, as Republicans were on their way to losing a close Senate race during vote counting after Election Day, Mr. Trump falsely claimed, quote, electoral corruption, unquote. Arizona officials, unlike workers in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, can pre-process mail ballots, but they can't begin processing ballots dropped off on Election Day until the polls are closed. And since many voters are in the habit of hanging on to their ballots until the last minute in the state, it leads to a significant slowdown. Nevada is also likely to take a while. As in 2020, it has sent mail-in ballots to every active registered voter in the state, which will likely increase mail voting over in-person voting. Nevada also counts mailed ballots received up to 4 days after the election, so long as they were mailed by election day. Depending on margins of victory, my expectation would be that Arizona and Nevada are the states that we're waiting on the longest to find out a call about the election, says Derek Tisler, a counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice's Elections and Government Process. He says that if margins of victory in key states are as close as they were in 2020, it will likely take about as long as it did 4 years ago to know who won. If the race is significantly closer, it will likely be weeks before we know who won the presidential election, he said. And that worries him. What we saw in 2020, he says, is the longer time is between voters finish casting their ballots and when we know who won the election, the more opportunity there is for disinformation about elections to spread. Now let's stay with the topic of our national elections for an article that comes to us from staff writer Ali Martin. Her article is titled, Beyond the Gender Gap, Presidential Politics is a, quote, masculinity contest. As early voting gets underway across the United States, one political divide has become clear. Most men prefer former President Donald Trump. Most women prefer Vice President Kamala Harris. That gap reflects party narratives throughout this election season, with Democrats leaning into issues like abortion access and economic equality, while Republicans have evoked traditional gender roles in discussing gun violence, child care, and family planning. This gender gap, while significant, actually goes back decades. What this campaign underscores is Americans' broader preference beyond gender for masculinity in the nation's highest office. The president doesn't have to necessarily be a man, but voters are still really liking a masculine presence at that level, says Lindsay Meeks, a University of Oklahoma professor who specializes in political communication and gender. Trump stumper Tucker Carlson at a rally this week implicitly referred to his presidential candidate as Dad. He unfurled a metaphor in which, quote, when Dad comes home, he deals with his misbehaving children, implicitly the Democrats. You've been a bad little girl and you're getting a vigorous spanking. It capped a campaign laden with hypermasculine images, from appearances with pro wrestlers to frequent use of aggressive language, including a recent vulgar reference to the late golf legend Arnold Palmer's anatomy. Former President Trump has consistently connected with male voters who value a certain type of crude masculine power figure. And Friday, he is set to record an interview with Joe Rogan, that was last Friday, the podcaster wildly popular with young male audiences, including young black men. Ms. Harris is walking a finer line, attempting to appeal to men while keeping her base among women. Her choice of Tim Walz as a running mate brought some balance to her femininity. But she's also played up her more masculine qualities as California's, quote, top cop and as a gun owner. And this week, former President Barack Obama rallied supporters on her behalf in Detroit alongside rapper Eminem, making a pointed appeal to young men to support the Democratic candidate. Projecting strength is trickier for women, says Dan Cassino, who conducts polling for Fairleigh Dickinson University. Female candidates have to be masculine, but not too masculine, and feminine, but not too feminine, whereas masculine male candidates just have to be masculine, unquote. Recent polling, he has concluded, illustrates those differences. Among registered voters, 41% say Mr. Trump is completely masculine. Of that share, 84% say they're going to vote for him. Some 54% say Ms. Harris expresses some degree of masculinity. Almost every election is, in fact, a masculinity contest. We just don't see it because it's been just two men, he says. To be taken seriously as a potential leader, you have to show masculine traits. The division along gender lines is stark. In a Pew Research Center survey this month, 51% of men and 43% of women lean towards supporting Mr. Trump. Ms. Harris has the mirror image of that support. 52% of women and 43% of men prefer her candidacy. Another Pew survey shows some voters believe those candidates' policies would benefit their corresponding gender and harm the other. Among registered voters, nearly half say a Harris presidency would help women, while 36% believe it would make things worse for men. 45% say a Trump win would make things better for men, and 46% say it would be worse for women. This polarity reflects ways in which the two political parties have solicited support for their respective platforms. Republicans have doubled down on gender stereotypes, while Democrats, until recently, have centered their messaging on issues important to women and racial minorities. Lost in this political gambit, some experts, are the real needs of contemporary men and boys. The main sound on issues of boys and men from the Democrats until very, very recently in the race has been the sound of silence, says Richard Reeves, founder and president of the American Institute of Boys and Men. Whereas on the Republican side, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of performance. Both parties are treating gender issues as a zero-sum game, says Mr. Reeves, adding, quote, I don't think it's good in the long run to have a men's party and a women's party. I think we have to rise together. A large draw for women to the Harris ticket has been the Democratic position on abortion access and other fertility-related options, says Dr. Meeks. Men tend to be more hawkish than women on defense and international relations, and they're more likely to be threatened by a Harris-Walls ticket that inverts historical gender norms. She adds, you could see any of those levers pushing men towards Trump over Harris. That's not to say that all men or women who depend on male success for their economic security don't support women's issues, but the rise of women's earnings and subsequent choices in recent years has made men less of an economic necessity for women, say experts. That is an amazing economic liberation, and exactly what the women's movement was about in that way, says Mr. Reeves. But this liberation for women has presented a difficult transition for men who face their own issues, including higher suicide rates and lower high school graduation rates than women, and other pressures related to working and making money. Republicans have tailored their messaging to acknowledge men in ways that Democrats have not, says Mr. Reeves. The basic underlying Republican message is, we are guys, we like guys, and we like the things that guys like. And so that's a strong cultural message from the right. But the contrasting messages around gender may have eroded the party's stronghold among black men, while another reliably Democratic bloc, Hispanic voters, is also shifting toward Mr. Trump. With the presidential race in a statistical dead heat, every vote matters, and the Harris camp is working to broaden its appeal, ramping up its pitch to men, while continuing to double down on issues that appeal to its current base, like abortion and equality. Now let's turn to one last article about the election today. This one comes to us from Austin, Texas, and is submitted by Henry Goss, staff writer. He updated this article on October 25th. His story is titled, With Senate Hopes Dwindling, Democrats Look Once Again to Texas. Just 11 days before an election expected to hinge on a handful of swing states, both major party presidential nominees descended on a state that, while not a presidential battleground, could be mighty important. On Friday, former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris took their campaigns to Texas. Mr. Trump in Austin, Ms. Harris in Houston. While both candidates used the appearances to amplify base issues, such as border security for Mr. Trump and abortion for Ms. Harris, they also aimed to give late boosts to candidates in what has become a critical U.S. Senate race. A Republican Senate candidate hasn't lost in Texas since 1988, but Senator Ted Cruz, considered an abrasive conservative even by some members of his own party, came close in 2018. Now, Colin Allred, a Dallas area congressman and former professional football player, hopes to oust him in what would be one of the biggest upsets of the election. As demographic changes in the Southwest have helped turn states like Arizona and Nevada into political battlegrounds, many analysts say that the Lone Star State is heading in the same direction. Still, while each election has brought fresh buzz that Republican dominance here is ending, that buzz has routinely evaporated on election night. There is little evidence that this year will be any different, but Texas is now more important to Democrats' electoral hopes than ever before. Ms. Harris's party, which currently holds a functional one-seat majority in the Senate, is defending far more seats than Republicans this cycle, including several in states that Mr. Trump won by big margins in 2020. With West Virginia all but certain to elect a Republican, and Montana looking increasingly likely to as well, that means that Democrats will need to flip a GOP seat to retain control. The focus has become Texas. It's still a long shot, experts say, but polls show Representative Allred is within striking distance, and as such, has become Democrats' best hope to hold the Senate and their next great hope to turn Texas purple. Texas has emerged as their best chance to flip a Republican-held seat, says Jessica Taylor, the Senate and Governor's editor for the Cook Political Report. It's been trending Democrat all recently, but is it there yet? I don't think so, she said. Those last few points in Texas are just incredibly hard to get. 6-year terms for senators help make each election map different from the last. The 2024 map is one that National Democrats have been fearing for a long time. We knew years ago that the map was going to be absolutely brutal going into this cycle, says Jim Manley, a Democratic strategist. So far, that's proven to be the case. Democrats ended 6 years of GOP control of the Senate in 2020, and 2 years later won a 51-49 majority. But now the blue team is defending 19 seats, plus four held by independents who caucus with them. Republicans, meanwhile, are defending 11 seats, all in reliably red states. Polls suggest that the GOP is likely to flip two seats, replacing retiring Senator Joe Manchin in West Virginia and ousting three-term incumbent Senator John Tester in Montana. Democratic incumbents are also facing tough races in Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Only a few states have polls suggesting that Republican incumbents may be remotely in danger. In the campaign's final weeks, Democrats are pouring money into two of them, Texas and Florida. Senator Cruz leads Mr. Allred by just 1 point, according to a poll released last week by Emerson College and The Hill. Other recent polls have the two-term Democrat slightly further behind, but Mr. Cruz has consistently been one of the least popular Republicans in Texas. He's a very controversial figure, always has been, always will be, says Whit Ayers, a GOP pollster based in Virginia. Mr. Allred, a former professional football player turned civil rights lawyer, has used his opponent's disagreeable reputation to build a big fundraising advantage. The Democrat has trumpeted his bipartisan record, and he's attacked Mr. Cruz's support for the state's abortion ban. Mr. Allred has also highlighted his opponent's infamous family vacation to Cancun, documented by reporters, during a deadly winter storm in 2021 that killed hundreds and left millions of Texans without power for days. When he returned, Mr. Cruz said the trip was obviously a mistake. As he campaigned, the Republican has highlighted his own burgeoning bipartisan record and criticized his opponent on border security and transgender issues. All told, Texas is the last best hope Democrats have for holding the Senate, says Brandon Rottinghouse, a political scientist at the University of Houston. Polling is close. You have a turbocharged electorate, and Ted Cruz remains uniquely unliked. That may still not be enough, he continues, but it's worth the investment now. It may seem like a Hail Mary pass this year, but Democrats' longer-term focus on Texas is understandable. For one, the state's 40 electoral college votes are essential to Republican presidential hopes. But the state is also becoming more competitive. Demographic changes have made the Southwest politically winnable for Democrats, namely a declining white population and a growing young Hispanic population, are also unfolding in the Lone Star State. The state's Republican margin of victory has narrowed in the past two presidential elections, and new voter registrations hit a record high this year. But the momentum has yet to translate to statewide victory for Democrats. In 2016, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton said her campaign, quote, could win Texas. She lost to Mr. Trump by 9 points. 2 years later, former Representative Beto O'Rourke's energetic grassroots campaign to unseat Mr. Cruz ended with a less than 3-point defeat. While Mr. Cruz himself had said that Texas would be hotly contested in the 2020 election, both Mr. Trump and GOP Senator John Cornyn won comfortably. I've been promised Texas turning blue for at least 6 to 8 years, and it hasn't happened yet, says Mr. Manley, the Democratic strategist who spent over 2 decades working in the Senate. It's reasonable to think it will happen, he adds. It's maybe just not going to happen as soon as some are suggesting. One factor, experts say, is that Texas is fundamentally more conservative than states like Nevada and Arizona. Indeed, while the state's urban centers have been growing bluer, the Hispanic population has been shifting in the GOP's direction. Texas is also much bigger, making it more difficult and much more expensive to build campaign infrastructure and name recognition for candidates. To date, the Democratic Party hasn't done much to change that. They're paying for ads, exposure, canvassing. They're not investing in physical things that might build infrastructure for the future, says Dr. Rodinghouse, the University of Houston political scientist, referring to the development of volunteer networks, fundraising sources, and slates of quality candidates for local and county elections around the state. This contrasts with how the GOP wrested the state from Democratic control in the late 20th century. When John Tower was elected to the Senate in 1961, he became the first Republican to win statewide office since Reconstruction. But it took another 3 decades for the GOP to gain proper traction in the state. You don't go from being non-competitive at the statewide level for cycles and cycles to all of a sudden becoming very successful, says Matt Makoviak, a Republican strategist in Texas. It's clear that Democrats are building something. Are they building it fast enough? Are they building it to make it strong enough to really break through? It doesn't seem that way to me, he adds. So an editor's note at the end here. This article was updated on October 25th, the date of initial publication, to reflect the fact that Trump and Harris events in Texas occurred as planned. Now let's turn to that ongoing conflict in the Middle East for an article that comes to us from Scott Peterson, staff writer. He submits this article from London. And it is titled, Israeli Strikes Inside Iran Cross a Threshold. How will Iran respond? Israel's unprecedented strike Saturday against 20 military targets inside Iran, its arch foe, show how far and how swiftly long-standing deterrence calculations are changing across the Middle East after more than a year of escalating conflict. The Iran-Israel conflict was once limited largely to a shadow war. It was marked on Israel's side by assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists, sabotage, and computer virus attacks, and on Iran's side by the buildup of allied militias from Lebanon and Gaza to Yemen, ready to target Israel. Now, Iran and Israel are openly striking each other's territory in blows that only recently seemed unthinkable. Before dawn on Saturday, Israel struck Iran's air defense systems, apparently paving the way for possible future strikes by knocking out Iran's 4 remaining Russian-made S-300 surface-to-air missile batteries and key radar arrays, which protected important energy installations. Israel also targeted sophisticated industrial mixing machines used to blend solid fuel for Iran's arsenal of ballistic missiles, which would be necessary to replace missiles fired at Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel, quote, hit hard Iran's defense capabilities and its ability to produce missiles that are aimed at us, unquote. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said the strikes should neither be magnified nor downplayed, and did not mention retaliation, though other officials did. Israel struck Saturday in response to an Iranian barrage of some 180 missiles and drones that rained down on Israel on October 1st, with dramatic scenes of night skies full of incoming rockets aimed at Israeli military air bases and Mossad headquarters. Iran's barrage was largely stopped by Israeli air defenses, with no loss of Israeli life, and was itself retaliation for previous Israeli attacks and high-profile assassinations against Iranian allies, including Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran and Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut. Both sides downplayed the impact of their enemies' direct strikes against them, while boasting of the impact of their own salvos. But the multiple unprecedented exchanges are changing strategic calculations. They have demonstrated Israel's ability so far to aggressively dominate the escalation, while drawing Iran into more conventional fight, where Israel has the advantage, even as Iran's pillars of deterrence have been shaken. On top of their direct battle, Israel has deeply damaged Hamas during a year of fighting that has laid waste to Gaza and left more than 40,000 Palestinians dead. And it has gone after Hezbollah and its much-vaunted missile arsenal in Lebanon with thousands of airstrikes and a ground incursion. Iran's deterrence is in ruins, says Ali Vaiz, director of the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group in Washington. He notes that the Islamic Republic, quote, has never been as vulnerable since the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, when missiles last landed in the capital, Tehran. Iran's regional shield, Hezbollah, has been cracked. Its Russian-made internal shield has been decimated, and its sword, made of ballistic missiles, has been dulled by Israel's multi-layered aerial defense system, says Mr. Vaiz. The result presents an impossible dilemma for Ayatollah Khomeini about how to respond, he says. On Khomeini's right shoulder sit the hawks of who warn of a Lebanon scenario in which lack of response only encourages Israel to escalate further, says Mr. Vaiz. On his left shoulder sit the more pragmatic forces of Iranian politics who warn against playing into Israel's hands and giving it an opening to destroy the country's strategic assets. Now that the red line of overt and direct strikes on Iran's soil has turned pink, Israel is playing to its own strength and exploiting Iran's conventional weakness, he adds. The current test for Iran's deterrence strategy began on October 7, 2023, when Hamas mounted a cross-border attack from Gaza into Israel. Iran praised the action as an act of legitimate Palestinian resistance, which left 1,200 Israelis dead and 250 held hostage in Gaza. The next day, the Lebanese Shiite militia, Hezbollah, opened what it called a support front by launching rocket attacks on northern Israel, triggering exchanges that quickly displaced 65,000 Israelis and 100,000 Lebanese from border areas. Throughout the conflict, Iran, beset by its own political and economic upheavals at home, made clear its desire to avoid a wider war. But incremental escalation finally led to an Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus, Syria, which killed senior Iranian military officials and prompted Iran's first direct barrage against Israel, with 300 missiles and drones in mid-April. They were mostly shot down by Israel and the United States, and that mild damage, combined with a lack of immediate Iranian retaliation for Mr. Haniyeh's assassination, set the stage for an audacious series of attacks against Hezbollah, which began on September 17th with the explosion of thousands of pagers. Nevertheless, the view from Tehran is that Iran's deterrence calculations with Israel still largely hold, despite the escalation into direct conflict, says Hassan Ahmadian, an assistant professor at the University of Tehran. The impression in Iran is that the, quote, axis of resistance is doing what it was supposed to do, and it is effective, though the damage has been big to Hamas, to a lesser extent to Hezbollah. But still, it's functional, it's working, says Dr. Ahmadian. Of course, the assassination of Haniyeh and Nasrallah might have given the impression to Netanyahu and the Israelis, well, we have a free hand now, let's go for the big guy, Iran. But then I think they are very fast, very soon, hitting the hard reality that it's not gone. Hezbollah is doing what it's doing. Indeed, Hezbollah has continued firing rockets daily into Israel, including 90 on Sunday, and its fighters have sought to stop the Israeli advance on the ground. With the missile barrages and airstrikes, the Israelis and Iranians are repeating the same message to the other side, that we can reach you, says Dr. Ahmadian. So it's either back to the indirect gray zone of the shadow war, which Iran has preferred for decades, or it leads to a tit-for-tat that has the potential of spiraling into something bigger. Shaping Iran's response to Israel's attack on Saturday may also be the lesson learned from Iran's delayed response to the assassination of Mr. Haniyeh, who was in Tehran for the inauguration of Iran's new pragmatic-leaning president, Masoud Pezeshkian, on July 31st. The timing of Iran's retaliation may also be an integral part of maintaining deterrence. In early August, when questions were being asked about the lack of a swift Iranian response, Dr. Ahmadian noted in a post on social platform X that failure to act decisively would lead to, quote, open season on Tehran and its allies. The Israelis received that inaction as a sign of weakness, and that's why Netanyahu moved into Lebanon, says Dr. Ahmadian. That mentality is still very strong in Iran. We didn't do it to retaliate after Haniyeh. They moved a step closer, and they did something bigger. Now they did something directly against Iran. If we don't do it, will they move closer to Iran or do something bigger? I think that presses hard on what Iranian leadership circles are thinking about. They have that experience in mind, he adds. That's why I am quite sure Iran will do something directly against Israel. Let's conclude our reading today with a book report, or a book review, I should say. This one titled, Reagan Left His Mark on the Republican Party and on the Presidency. This article comes to us from Danny Heitman, who is a contributor to the Monitor. 40 years have passed since Ronald Reagan, the dominant figure of 20th century American conservatism, waged his final campaign for the presidency. Reagan's landslide re-election in 1984 affirmed his stature as a political force, and his legacy continues to resonate as Americans navigate another important election year. With that in mind, Reagan, Max Boot's new biography of the 40th president, couldn't be more timely. Timing was obviously much on his mind, as Boot, a historian, foreign policy analyst, Washington Post columnist, and former Christian Science Monitor staffer, worked on this ambitious account of Reagan's life. Reagan occupied the White House from 1981 to 1989, and a dwindling number of his administration's key figures are still around. Boot managed to interview quite a few, and Reagan could very well be the last biography of its kind to draw on so many personal conversations with key primary sources. In his introduction, Boot laments that while much has been written about Reagan, there is still no definitive biography. Given the scope of his research, which also uses extensive archival material, the author clearly wanted to leave no stone unturned. Is Reagan definitive? Perhaps that ideal will remain elusive, since Reagan, who died at 93 in 2004, was famously hard to define. He had almost no close friends, and his only abiding confidant, apparently, was his wife, Nancy. One of his closest aides, Michael K. Deaver, confessed, quote, "At times Ronald Reagan has been very much a puzzle to me." While his longtime secretary, Helene Von Damme, wrote that, quote, "He was fundamentally a very difficult man to know." Reagan's inscrutability most memorably confounded biographer Edmund Morris, who was so stumped in trying to discern the former president's character that he threw up his hands and wrote Dutch, a 1999 project that ditched conventional biography and probed his subject through speculative fiction. For a more straightforward exposition of Reagan's times, Richard Reeves's President Reagan, The Triumph of Imagination, remains hard to beat. In focusing more narrowly on the president's White House years, Reeves yielded a swift read. Reagan, The Life, a 2015 biography by H.W. Brands, is especially useful for its insights into the president's domestic policies. Perhaps not surprisingly, given Boot's experience in foreign policy, he's especially astute at unpacking Reagan's diplomacy. Although the president was widely celebrated for working in tandem with Pope John Paul II to help bring down the Soviet Empire, Boot argues that the relationship was more nuanced, with the leaders sometimes sharing goals but also having significant differences about how they should be advanced. Reagan's partnership with fellow conservative and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, often depicted as one of unbridled mutual admiration, comes in for a reappraisal too. Thatcher was more cerebral and sometimes sighed at Reagan's loose command of policy details. Yet even though Thatcher remained doubtful about Reagan's intellect Boot writes. She always appreciated his political instincts because they tallied so closely with her own on most issues. The president loved anecdotes, continuing to repeat them even when confronted by evidence of their falsehood. Reagan had a disturbingly cavalier attitude toward factual accuracy that, arguably, helped to inure the Republican Party to fake news, the author laments. If his pronouncements could sometimes be fanciful, Reagan's background in the movie industry kept him alert to the theatrical aspects of leadership. As one of his speechwriters, Peggy Noonan, put it, quote, "What always struck me was his friendly grace, his enjoyment of the moment and of other people, and his intuitive understanding of the presidential style," unquote. As he shouldered one of the most eventful presidencies in history, Reagan found his Hollywood experience invaluable. "There have been times in this office," he admitted, "when I wondered how you could do the job if you hadn't been an actor," unquote. The title of the book, again, is Reagan, His Life and Legend, written by Max Boot, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. And that brings us to the conclusion of our reading today. I thank you very much for joining me for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Englewitz. As always, I wish you a most pleasant, safe, and healthy day, and we invite you to please stay tuned for our next regularly scheduled program.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.